Major Vizard, Reel 17. We got to the point where you got back to the Athens area, and you'd had the Brigadier's O Group. You'd heard that you'd have a general security responsibility.
Yes. This was Brigadier Fox, and was relieved that the truce had been called. A truce is just a truce. Nobody was firing at each other any longer, but the action was not finished. And although we didn't take any part in it, there was considerable probing movements and negotiations went on in the southern part of the Peloponnese. Anyway, we were told that we had a general duty in aid of civil power. Well, we understood that. It meant that we didn't have to take over the police stations and staff them and deal with complaints, which is an appalling task. The Augustus had it. They took over the police stations in Piraeus, and they had all manner of domestic disputes brought to them, which they were totally unable to resolve because nobody spoke Greek. Anyway, we weren't required to do that in Athens, but we were required to support the security services, and we were also required to do some training, and we were required to help train a body of troops which the Greek government was forming, called the Greek National Guard. Now, this was, to my mind, a strongly loyalist body of men. I wasn't impressed with their military prowess, but they were all volunteers, as far as I can make out. They had little or no pay. They had rations. They had smokes. And they had billets and so forth. But they were poorly equipped, poorly clothed. But we trained them. It was very basic, I remember. I don't think it ever got beyond firing range for rifles and instruction on how to assemble and disassemble brain guns. That's about the limit of it. And I remember there was training going on, and we had, I think, two companies of them. And the Greek company is 200 men, quite a lot. And we did some training of our own because we needed it. And the whole battalion was, it was cold. Most of the men were under, well, all the men were under cover. Anybody who did it was a Greek, so it was still only, there was no sign of the spring, it was still winter. And we stayed there, and we didn't move. The rest of us, of course, who were also doing something similar in Athens, they pulled out. I think they went back to Patras, under command of 138. But we remained in Greece, because that extended our duties, and I can remember the colonel had allocated different parts of the city as particular responsibilities for different companies. And we had six companies. We had the four rifle companies that were supporting their crews. The city was divided into six areas, and we each given an area. And we had to go along and make contact with the mayor and the nomarch. The police chief, most of those of course spoke English, so it was not too difficult. Quite a few of the troops have picked up quite a bit of Greek, kitchen Greek. It is, looking back on all this, the one thing that sticks out in my mind, and this is true of all the campaigns, is the adaptability of the British soldier. You can pick him up and put him down into a totally unfamiliar, alien atmosphere where he doesn't understand what people are talking about. He's highly suspicious of all the people around about, and they're hostile or they're friendly or they're in between. But within the space of at the most 48 hours, he will have completely adapted himself to the new surrounding, like a chameleon. And before you know where you are, chickens appear. Eggs, tomatoes, melons, and so forth. Washing is being done by Greek women. the men are talking to them, nearly always the women, the married women, and there's chats going on. And how they do it, I don't know, but there's this tremendous ability to adapt. And it happens over and over again. And whatever the circumstances, hostile, difficult, cold, wet, yes, never mind, you'd still get this adaptability to the environment. And it was one of the great assets. I suppose it always has been one of the great assets. The British soldier is basically friendly and gets on with people. So there we are. Anyway, we remained there until the time came for the withdrawal back to Italy. We were delighted to read in our divisional magazine, our divisional paper, The Oak Tree, how well things were going on the Second Front, and how the Russians were pushing on, how Germany was being invaded, and so forth. It was all grist to our mill, because we knew then that that things were turning. And it did an awful long haul. We remember in 1935, and it all began in 39. It seemed a lifetime. We went back. It was a very dusty staging, dirty sort of place. Staging post in Athens that we assembled up. And then we embarked, and we went back to Taranto. And I think it's about that time in Taranto, I think, when we heard of the general surrender of the southern German armies, which was, we received that with mixed feelings. We had been with the 8th Army of the Third Italy across from Sicily. We had been the first people into Italy, 46, early at Salerno, and we would like to have been, I think, in pursuit, but we weren't to have it. They surrendered and raced north, consolidating especially. So we moved up, and I remember some went by road, and I went by road with the quartermaster. Some people went by train. They slow, the road was quicker. And we seemed to be in the Bologna, Route 9, where we'd more or less finished fighting before. Lamoni, Route 9, Forli, Faenza, falling properly, Sant'Arcangelo. That's where the division. And we were given orders, which was strange. They said, move north as quickly and as far as you can. There was some opposition, not a lot. The fanatical units had stayed behind. Most of the German army had moved out. They moved all on the road. And it was a question of who moved the fastest, but they weren't in a mood to retaliate. Anyway, I can remember we went by road and crossed over, over the Alps.
Do you remember any of the festivities on Armistice Day itself? Because apparently you ran a race meeting, and there was a decorated Jeep contest and various other things. Do you remember any of this?
Yes, that was it. I think that was the, wasn't VE Day, was it?
The day after VE Day, March the 9th, I think.
VE Day, yes. Yeah. I remember it had started in Greece. A tremendous, I think it was because Greece was the home of the Olympic Games. And they had a lot of sporting facilities. And I can remember a tremendous amount of athletics in Greece, more than we'd ever seen before. People were running half marathons. There was discus and javelin. And I think when we got back to the north of Italy, and everybody was in an easier frame of mind, because although we were disappointed not to be in for death, we were very disappointed. And it was only a matter of a week, perhaps two, nonetheless, it was obvious that we were going to have more frequent leaves. I mean, we'd only had one leave up to now. I forgot to mention that while we were in Italy the second time, there was this method of LOC, they called it, lines of communication leave, because Europe had been cleared sufficiently for them to be able to get three time traps through. So we could see that we were going to have better leaves and so forth. And I do remember there being a games. I remember this horse racing that we used to have, betting on horses. And unlike the Greek situation where hospitality was forthcoming readily, the Italians, after all, they had a pretty hard time of it one way or the other, and their farmhouses, the old farmland, had been, to some extent, gently ravaged. I mean, the Germans had been there, and then the Germans were pushed out, and the British came in, they were gently ravaged again. I can remember seeing great storehouses which had been full of apples. They'd all gone, they'd taken all the apples. I remember when we got to Cesena, there was a great winery and huge vats. And the Jerry had pulled out, he just opened the taps. I mean, the streets were running in wine. And so the whole area didn't have much to offer. So we didn't get all that much of celebration. Yes, the spirits were high. The nappy ration was improved. I remember the cigarettes and chocolate were more freely available. I got more flour and sugar for the PRI, for the benefits, as it were. The Martin's cigarettes became freely available. I shouldn't say that because it was very kind of them to send them out. But they used to send out Martin's and they used to send out cake to Cairo, which were so full of saltpeter that it was like holding a sort of sparkler in your mouth when you lit it. But that's a rather ungenerous remark because after all these were all gift parcels sent by well-being people. We did get, we did have that, but we moved over the Alps, we came down through Valacchio. The only thing I remember about Valacchio was that I went in the houses to see whether there was any lurking goatees, and there weren't. And anyway, I went in the houses, and the thing that I noticed was the lights were on the daytime. And now I looked at the walls, and they hadn't got any switches. It was cheaper to equip every house with a burning lamp rather than put the switches on, because it was all hydro from the water on the Alps. We came down, convoys, our convoy, the whole of 139 Brigade came down.
Well, then, what sign of the German army? They're returning as well on the roads.
There were signs of broken down vehicles, that's all. The main bodies had cleared the way, gone. I think that's why they held these celebratory things, given time to get out the road. But there were broken down vehicles and groups of rejected looking chaps that they offered no resistance. In fact, I can remember a lot of cheers going up, and they waved to each other. The troops in three towers, when they saw these fellows working on Japs, taking wheels off and so forth, there were ironic cheers, and each side waved to the other. They knew it, their war was over. They were going to be taken prisoner. We moved into the Klagenfurt area, which was very pleasant. And we were allocated an area. First of all, we went to St. Veit. I remember St. Veit. And then to the village or town of Wildern, which is by the Wörthersee, a very large lake. And the companies were allocated areas. The Italian headquarters was and headquarters company were both in Zildone, which you can describe as a large village or a small town. I suppose it had about 8,000 people or something like that.
Well, how did you get on with the Austrians? Because would there be a no fraternisation?
Well, at first, we got off on the wrong foot, as you always do when you go into somebody else's country and into their towns, because you had to billet the troops. And this meant the old story, which we've been going through all the way through Italy, doubling up, going to a house, Permesso, and through the door you'd go, and then you'd, without even asking, you'd walk up the stairs, look at the number of bedrooms and so forth, and say, right, there are 12 rooms in this house, you have six, we have six. And then it doesn't get you off on the right foot when the grandma has to be moved out and carried downstairs and put into another room and so on. It all causes a certain amount of resentment. And we had the same thing in building. I remember I wanted to set up the officer's mess, because we hadn't had one. We did have a sort of officer's mess in Athens, but it was very poor. So I wanted to set up the officer's mess, the Irish Freshman's Mess, as well as PRI and General Dunn's Body. And the most suitable place was a substantial building with a courtyard, under an arch into a courtyard, and a substantial building at the back. And I went in there, and there was an English-speaking Austrian woman, and I said to her, I'm very sorry, but we're going to have to share your home. And she said, this is monstrous. My husband is a doctor, and he is away fighting. I said, well, not anymore, but he has been away fighting. And she said, it's my home. I said, very sorry, very sorry. We've come all the way from Africa. We didn't start things, you know. So we had to move in. And the question of fraternization really didn't come up. Because, I mean, they wouldn't fraternize with us. But this didn't last very long, because the British soldier with his unbeatable talents for getting to know people, whether he's instructed to or not. And it wasn't long before a much more friendly atmosphere prevailed. But I had trouble with my doctor's wife. I used to send her little gifts, because she retreated right to the far end of the courtyard, and she occupied about three rooms. It was a large place, because you see, he'd got treatment centres and surgery and all that kind of thing. He was the doctor for the whole area, poor chap. And I never saw him return. I don't know whether he ever survived or not. Anyway, I used to send her little gifts of a bar of chocolate or half a pound of sugar and that sort of thing from the nappy rations to keep her sweet. She was very appreciative. There was an armed neutrality in it. Even when we went, it was still there. But we settled in pretty well, by and large, and the Leicesters, they weren't very far away, the Osseo-Zaccaje area. And they sent us a work, Arbeitensgruppe, a working party of German prisoners. Two officers and 40 men. I included the SEP, and I included the nominal number in the Christmas newsletter. It's the original nominal role. They used to put a nominal role in every morning of what their duties were, and they were allocated. Two to each rifle company, and two to the stables, because they acted as grooms. There were horses around, and the colonel was very keen on riding, and the second in command was keen on riding.
Now these horses, they come from the German army in this. there's quite a craze on horse riding at the time, according to the Stringer's book.
Yes, but you see, one of their duties while we were here was a very sad one, of rounding up and guarding the Cossack division. Now, these people were white Russians, and they'd been fighting the Reds, they'd been fighting with the Germans. And they had an entire division's horses. I think there were something like 10,000 horses. Cossack Moscow wasn't at all of them. There was an enormous number of these men. And they were under canvas. The weather wasn't too bad by then, I suppose. But they were under canvas. And their horses were available. And of course, if you but mostly that prisoner of war group were used for cookhouse duties, chopping wood, growing water, all those sort of things. A couple went down to the motor transport, and because they were fitters, and the relationship with them as the months went by. Remember, we were there until February 46. As the months went by, the relationship with them became, well, quite friendly. These were just all new, honest to God, Wehrmacht. There were, as far as I could see, no fanatical Nazis, nothing like that. Both the officers spoke English. I used to go down sometimes in the evening, because they were technically my responsibility. I used to go down, used to discuss their problems with them. Mail was their biggest problem, and I used to have to get in touch with the AMQ branch at brigade and division to get their mail. It was very difficult to get mail from German prison war. This is what it was. The Red Cross were there, but it didn't seem terribly effective. It was very difficult for the Red Cross because there were so many prisoners and they were so scattered. In the camps, it's a lot easier, I think. But our 40-odd men, 46 or 48 or something like that, I know they were always saying, can we not have some mail? I seem always to be talking to the brigade and division staff about mail, because they had the contact with the Red Cross. Eventually, they did begin to get some, but it took a long time. And I used to take down a bottle of wine or a bottle of whiskey or something that we used to have drink together. The leader came from Schleswig-Holstein. To their credit, none of them said that they wished they hadn't joined up. They both said, well, it was our job, just as it was your job. And the war was declared. That was it. He'd been on the Russian front. He'd got the red, white, and black ribbon across his tunic. And he had a bad time in Russia and complained about it. Terrible conditions. And the other one had been in charge of an Italian company in Italy. So that went off quite right. The Padre, of course, was always. He held services regularly in a local church. We used to have a lot of sporting activity. We had some boating activity. And the Christmas.
Can I just add, one thing we've missed is that when you were before Wilden, Blyberg, near Bruckel, I don't know whether you actually went there, there was a bit of a problem with some of the Croats and things there.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember that? That's earlier, but I mean, we could drop that in.
Yes, we came through Caporetto. We came through the Caporetto Pass. And that's where the Austrians fought the Hungarians or something in the previous war. Caporetto Pass. And when we got to the top, we were actually technically in Yugoslavia. I've forgotten that. We came through the Caporetto Pass, and we were technically in Yugoslavia. I'm trying to think. Ljubljana, that's it. That was the area we were in, Ljubljana. And we were bowling along, and the convoy stopped, and the colonel was in front, and I was behind him, and the court captain. And I moved up the convoy to see what had happened to hold it up. And there was a cloud of dust in front, and a pretty big cloud of dust. And I could see in the front, through the dust, a sort of formation. I didn't know what it was. In fact, the companies were deploying on either side and sort of flanked in case this was some sort of attack. But out of the cloud of dust appeared a group of civilians with goats and sheep and cattle. And it was they that were creating the dust. And anyway, when they were about, I suppose, 200 or 300 yards off, the colonel got out of his jeep and walked up the road and sort of held his hand up like that. And from what I could make out from some interpreters that we had with us, this was part of the Croat nation on the march. And I suppose they were doing something very similar to what they've been doing in recent years, moving from one part of Yugoslavia to another part of Yugoslavia. They seem to be cursed. But there must have been, I don't know, they moved off the road because the cattle were, I mean, they occupied a quarter of a mile. Their vehicles were on the road, but the cattle were being driven along. And I remember we passed through them. Anyway, they weren't hostile. But,
do you know what happened to them?
I have no idea. I repaid no part in settling them. They were on the move. I mean, I suppose that they were. We had to go to ground at night because we ran into Ljubljana, which was the headquarters, one of the smaller headquarters of Tito. And his partisans were wild, totally wild. And as the war was ended, their idea of enjoying life was to get as drunk as they possibly could and fire off their weapons. They weren't very careful where they fired them. The result of that was that you, especially in an armoured vehicle, you had to go to ground in a slip trench. We all had to do a start digging slip trenches at the end of the July at night because the whole area was lit up by a tracer. Every kind of small arms was being discharged. And it was great life, a threat to life and limb with these Tito's partisans. I think they did a good job. They were clothed in civilian clothes with a cap with a red star. One or two of them had a uniform, but most of them were virtually in civilian clothing. And that was while we were en route towards Klagenfurt, because east of that area of Austria lies Yugoslavia and Croatia. No, not Croatia. Slavia. Slavia. And then Croatia.